All right, good morning, everybody. Today is Wednesday, October 28th, 2015, and this is Before the First Cup with Jules here on UCY.TV. Happy, soggy Wednesday, everybody. It is 49 degrees with heavy rain here in upstate New York. We are getting supposedly the remnants of Patricia down from the south. She came cruising right on up on the jet stream and hit New York State like she was bowling. So I don't know. It's pouring here pretty good. We're supposed to get 50 to 60 mile an hour winds, so that should take care of the last of the leaves that are on the trees. But it's all right. Looks like nighttime. I have a daylight bulb turned on here, so I'm pretending that it's sunny and warm. So where do we leave off yesterday? We looked at some pretty interesting things. We titled the show Frequencies Shattering Cancer and Live TV Brain Surgery. There was a professor out of Skidmore College that we listened to a TEDx presentation that he gave in regards to research that he'd done with frequencies. And he had partnered with some cancer researchers, and they had some incredible results. There were all different kinds of cancers, leukemias, ovarian, and I'm trying to remember the third one. There were three of them that they, by putting these frequencies onto the cancer cells under a microscope, they actually showed the microscopic destruction of these cancer cells. It caused the cells themselves to shatter, as would a glass if you found its resonant frequency. And it's pretty incredible. So he created a not-for-profit, and I saw they're even taking donations from $1 to whatever. I'm very impressed. And I mean, the guy definitely seemed like his heart was in the right place. I'm a little worried about if this technology gets into the wrong hands, because if you can use a resonant frequency to shatter living cells, of course, you could see that would be a problem if the evil ones or the military got their hands on that. But on the other hand, used as a cancer therapy, they don't believe there would be any type of bad side effects, because at the frequencies that he was using, and I believe, I couldn't remember after we listened to the clip, but yesterday I listened again, and it was 100 kilohertz or 100,000 hertz, anywhere between 100 kilohertz and 300 kilohertz didn't heat the tissue surrounding the cancer. It only caused the cancer to shatter. So if you haven't seen that, the name of the company he started was called Nova Biotronics. It's novabiotronics.com. And the professor's name was Anthony Holland. The title of the video is Shattering Cancer with Resonant Frequencies. I highly recommend it. I also put the link to the video in the notes from yesterday's show. You can find those on UCY's YouTube channel. It's youtube.com/UCYTV. And of course, my playlist is Before the First Cup. And if you didn't know that, then you need some coffee. But we also looked at then the live brain surgery on television. And I got to tell you guys, kind of laid the groundwork looking at how they're, with all this mad science gone mad, they're trying to normalize all this stuff. And so by putting live brain surgery on TV, and of course, it was to treat someone who had had Parkinson's for the last 10 years and couldn't stop his tremors. But we had dug deep into some of the issues for Parkinson's, and Parkinson's is one of those diseases that comes from a lack of dopamine in the brain. We know that DARPA had been doing research not only with PTSD, but also with being able to push a button once they had electrodes in your head and cause the brain to produce certain chemicals at the push of a joystick. So it was really disturbing when I saw this, because this is the same experimentation. I dug into quite a few articles after the show yesterday because I knew this was the same experimentation that DARPA was doing, and it absolutely is. So here we want to normalize Johnny getting live first time ever brain surgery on TV. So everyone will go, wow, look, that brain surgery and putting in that implant. And they are. They're these little stretchy electrodes that they've been working on. Put in the brain implant to then be able to manipulate the brain. This is really the very next step to this transhumanist, sick, twisted human 2.0 agenda. Going to change gears a little bit today. This is actually what I was going to work on yesterday for the show, but then I saw that video and I really wanted to share that. But we're going to dig into some of what's going on in the food system, some of the PSYOP now that's going on. We mentioned very briefly yesterday about the UN coming out and discussing how red meat and processed foods are cancerous now, and they put them into the same cancer-causing groups as asbestos and cigarettes, okay? Now, if there wasn't an agenda behind that one, I don't know what is. But we've also, in the past, taken a look at the complete and utter breakdown, if there even was one, of our regulatory agencies that are supposed to be keeping us safe. We looked at the FDA and all of the removal of our labeling laws, not only for country of origin, but the TPP is going to get rid of, you know, having to tell you where it comes from or whether or not there's GMOs. We have this whole DARC Act that's sitting waiting to be passed, which will get rid of any GMO labeling that's been out there and passed at a local level already, because they don't want us to know what's in our food. Like I said before, shut up and eat it. We know what's good for you. You know, the elite are going to have the steaks and we're going to have the cricket protein is what it's going to end up being. Well, there is a changing of the guards that is going on now in the FDA, and I know Obama had actually talked about potentially merging the FDA and the USDA at one point because, you know, they can't keep up on all this stuff. Oh my God, there's so many imports. We also discovered that stuff that's being imported isn't necessarily being inspected one by one. By anyone on this side of the fence, they allow these importing companies to build their own inspection facilities. Then we just kind of give it the blessing. We go there and we're like, yep, you're doing it to our standards. We'll allow you to inspect all your own food and then ship it to our country and we'll spot check it, you know. And then we read that whole thing about how they did imports back probably a month or two ago. You can find that. Go, I'm sure I put it into one of the titles and you'll find the articles in the description. But I ran across a story yesterday. Actually, looks like it's about a week or so old, from Carrie Wedler out of Anti-Media. And I wanted to share this with you. Obama's new appointee to head the FDA is a big pharma mega lobbyist. Well, who would have ever guessed that one? We have these revolving doors between Monsanto and our regulatory food and drug agencies. And now we're talking about putting in a big pharma mega lobbyist. Now that we have this precision care, precision healthcare, and the bioeconomy that's all up and rolling here to turn us into real-time guinea pigs. I mean, it just makes sense to put a big pharma lobbyist at the head of the FDA. Says President Obama's recent nominee to chair the Food and Drug Administration has drawn harsh criticism for his ties to the pharmaceutical industry. This disapproval grew more justified this week as it was revealed that until this year, nominee Dr. Robert Califf was a board member and a consultant for a company whose sole purpose is to help the pharmaceutical companies evade and manipulate FDA regulations. Ha! Huh, who would have believed that one? He currently serves as the FDA's deputy commissioner for medical products and tobacco and awaits Senate confirmation to become the deputy commissioner of the agency. Now, even more interesting is if he is currently serving as the FDA's deputy commissioner for medical products, and now he's going to be confirmed to be the deputy commissioner of the agency. You know why? Because they're probably not going to need his old position anymore for keeping an eye on medical products. And you want to know why? Well, remember, we took a look oh, I don't know, all the days bleed together, but it was probably last week and the week before and probably even back in February or March, we looked at this 21st Century Care Act that is working its way through Congress. We listened to that video a couple different times now with a couple of our Congress people touting all the wonderful ways that direct medicine to the consumer without regulatory agencies, because, you know, those pesky regulatory agencies are holding up life-saving cures to you and me. No, we don't need to regulate that stuff anymore. Let's give it directly to the sick and desperate and the ones who would be most apt to open their arms to brain implants or nanobots in their blood. And then once we find out if there's any type of success, then we can do a case study, kind of like they do in the technology field. That's how we sell stuff in technology. You don't do 10 years of research. You do 5 years of research, and then you basically give it away to corporations. You drop your pants, drop the price, give it away, let it work really well in a large organization, and then do a case study and use that case study to then sell it to everybody else. I mean, that is an old tactic that they are using. So anyway, let's get back to this. Faculty Connection LLC, where Khalif served from 2006 to 2015, claims the company, quote, brings together physicians and researchers from leading academic institutions with pharmaceutical, biotechnology, and medical device clients. Wow. So he sounds like he's right in bed with everyone we love to hate. As The Intercept reported, Faculty Connection LLC, quote, boasts that its team of practicing university-based physicians and researchers provides regulatory consulting, including expertise in FDA briefing reviews and other submissions to the agency. Now, you know, it's just amazing to me because we know that a lot of federal dollars, DARPA dollars, Project BioShield dollars, Department of Defense dollars are sprinkling over all of these different universities for them to come up with the newest cure, the newest mad science. A lot of the pharmaceutical companies also finance different departments in universities. So don't think that there's any unbiased opinion going on here. I love the way they make it sound, the Faculty Connection. Oh, yes, the free thinkers at the universities. But always remember where their paycheck comes from, because it's only as free as the money is flowing. All right, back to Carrie's story. Further, an official corporate video notes the company has, quote, served over 175 different pharma, biotech, medical device firms, claiming to help faculty, researchers, doctors, and academics work side by side with the pharmaceutical industry. For example, Dr. Mona Fitzatz, a consultant for the Faculty Connection LLC, has participated in the preparation for cardiorenal advisory committee presentations to the FDA on behalf of the drug sponsors, according to her biography on the company's website. And we've seen a lot of that. There actually was one, and I don't have the story in front of me, but there was one about a scientist who would come out in defense of glyphosate, Monsanto's glyphosate. And when you trace the money back, it was fully 100% proven that the financing was coming from Monsanto itself. And so all of these quote unquote independent researchers really are not independent. We've also found out in FDA studies, right? So at least the FDA has studies out there, right? No, but now they've discovered that a majority, at least half of the studies could be fraudulent or at least disproven after being published and were never redacted. So the FDA isn't doing anything to keep you and me safe. And there are people out there that try to refute what we say that still point to those studies and say, but look, they proved that glyphosate was safe, that you could drink gallons of it and not have any issues. I mean, why would you believe? We've proved that vaccines are safe, that autism has no connection to the MMR vaccine, as we've had a senator, off the top of my head, I don't remember his name, but twice now, not once, he came out once in the summer, and once a couple weeks ago now, he has come out in front of Congress with whistleblower papers that he has in his possession from one of the researchers at the CDC saying that the MMR vaccine did show evidence of autism. And what did they do? Well, the CDC actually destroyed the documents. This senator actually has the documents because one of the researchers had a conscience. So you can't believe any research that's out there. And again, it's all about following where the dollars originated. All right, back to Carrie's story. Khalif previously came under fire for helping to establish the Duke Clinical Research Institute, which is funded primarily by pharmaceutical companies. According to a 2014 conflict of interest disclosure, Cahill admitted that his close connections, he admitted the close connections to the industry, and as time summarized, his income is contractually underwritten in parts by several large pharmaceutical companies, including who? Merck, Bristol Myers Squibb, Eli Lilly, and Novartis. He also received as much as $100,000 a year in consulting fees from some of those same companies and from others. The FDA insists that he donates his private income to nonprofits. Oh, nice. Even so, Khalif's appointment is hardly surprising. Good old Michael Taylor, who is the current deputy commissioner for foods at the FDA, also appointed by Barack Obama, used to be who? Monsanto's vice president for public policy. Collusion between corporations and the FDA is widely documented, and this influence has presumably contributed to many questionable decisions, such as, and yes, we haven't talked a lot about this one, the FDA's approval of OxyContin for children, or the ongoing approval of countless dangerous drugs that are later recalled. How about all the glyphosate that's being sprayed all over and deemed to be safe for you and me, yet they tell us that steaks will kill you on the level of asbestos? Khalif, however, puts a positive spin on his conflict of interest. Earlier this year, when he was only a potential nominee, he told Time magazine that he was a valuable candidate because it would, quote, be useful to have someone leading the FDA who understands how companies operate because you are interacting with them all of the time, unquote. And I mean, yes, wouldn't that be just so useful to have someone with lots and lots of tendrils into the corporatocracy that is taking over our federal government? I mean, it just makes things easier. Rubber stamp it even more than you have been before. Now it's not going to be just GMO foods. Now it's going to be 21st Century CARES Act. Let's get it direct to consumer. In spite of Khalif's rhetoric, sordid ties like his continually prove the depths of corruption and the state's lack of concern for the people it is tasked with protecting, which it really isn't. They're just pretending to protect. And in the United States, 70% of Americans consume pharmaceutical pills. And I will guarantee you there's at least 70% of Americans who also consume GMOs, considering that the majority of the corn and the soybeans in this country are genetically modified. That is a figure, perhaps, that reveals the consequences of placing corporate puppet masters in charge. And, you know, this is happening at the FDA, but don't for one second believe that this is not happening at all levels of government. All right, now we're going to continue, since we're already on the mad science gone mad in our pills and in our food. Let's take a look at some stuff we've looked at before. Food Democracy Now! Had put out really nice little snippets of quite a long interview by Dr. Huber. We've talked about Dr. Huber before, and we're going to take a look at Dr. Huber's biography after we look at some of the things that he's talked about. Back on January 17th, and I don't remember what year it was a few years ago, internationally recognized plant pathologist Dr. Don Huber wrote a letter to the USDA secretary, and again, another Monsanto shill, Tom Vilsack, warning that the discovery of a new pathogen and a possible link between Roundup Ready GMO corn and soybeans and severe reproductive problems in livestock, as well as widespread crop failure. Now, since we have the majority of our farms in this country spraying their crops, corn and soybeans and alfalfa, there's all kinds of stuff going on now with glyphosate. And that glyphosate is negatively affecting reproduction in our livestock, including cows that, they make beef, as well as crops. So if our crops are dying and we have droughts and we have all the animals not reproducing, you can really see where this is leading. We are manufacturing a food shortage. It says less than 3 weeks later, after Dr. Huber's letter to Tom Vilsack, the Obama administration approved two, not one, but two new Roundup Ready GMO crops set to be planted in the spring. And I'd like to take a look at a little bit of this. So Dr. Huber talks about, and let's see if we can get this. I'm not sure what each of these videos are, but we're going to check it out. Let me connect here first to myself. I should have done that before. I'm sorry. But I was working on trying to get these in some sort of order. All right, here we go. So we're going to listen to a little tiny snippet of an interview between Dr. Huber, if my Skype doesn't lock up, it's what happens when I have speakers plugged in. All right, it's trying to connect. Come on. Let's go. Don't break my mojo. Well, it looks like it's connected. I guess we'll find out, won't we? Oh, please hurry.
You know about glyphosate and its impact on other crops. I'm curious, you're now more concerned about how Roundup Ready alfalfa will impact dairy herds, cattle, and hogs in the U.S.
If this organism is associated with alfalfa after glyphosate application, like it is with the corn and the soybeans, mm-hmm. That one I would express a very serious concern. When you take our number one forage crop, mm-hmm. and you place it in any kind of jeopardy, we have a tremendous impact on the sustainability of our animal production. Because with alfalfa as a perennial crop, open pollinated with an insect vector, the bee is the vector for the pollen, that in 5 years, you won't have anything except Roundup Ready alfalfa. Mm-hmm. There's no way that you can have any coexistence unless it defies all of the epidemiological data that we've accumulated for 100 years on plant diseases. There's no way to maintain a non-Roundup Ready population of alfalfa.
Knowing what you know and knowing the science so far, what you understand, you know, what advice would you give to President Obama and Secretary Vilsack in terms of moving forward with the recent approvals of Roundup Ready alfalfa and sugar beets? Would you advise them to hold off?
Well, I put it in my letter, a request that they would delay any decision until we had the answers that I feel are very critical, and establish a need. Why add another... or why continue to abuse a system that we can already see is badly abused?
And that's such a great question, Dr. Huber. I mean, they already know that there's issues with this stuff. He's been doing research for 50 years on plant pathology and disease. One of the things that he's discovered is about the depletion, the chelation of micronutrients out of the soil. It also... causes animals and insects not to be able to absorb proper micronutrients. So here, I want to play this as well because this is going to lead up to something.
What are some, I guess, crop diseases that, that corn and soybean farmers have experienced?
The last 2 years, we've had a very significant epidemic of Gosses wilt on corn and sudden death syndrome on soybeans. We've had to increase the rate of glyphosate, so we've just continually hammered against those organisms that would give us some natural biological control of that disease. The mode of action of glyphosate as an herbicide is to suppress resistance and increase disease, so that when you have any weed that's killed by glyphosate, you've increased its susceptibility to disease. Plant pathologists are also seeing that increased disease and the inability to keep their crop production, their growers, efficient and in business. And then you look at the quality of that crop that's been produced, which we're growing initially for food and feed, even if it's going into alcohol. The rest of that crop's used for feed, and we find very high populations of this organism in the distiller's grain. So it's coming through the ethanol production, the fermentive process. Find it very high in corn silage. So that the insling process seems to give it in an environment where it's even able to continue to grow even beyond what it did in the regular growth of the plant.
And in that video clip a little bit later on, Dr. Huber discusses the reason for all of these plant diseases is because they are not getting the proper nutrients out of the soil. And I mean, the thing is plants and humans do have a lot in common. We do both require nutrients to live, thrive, and grow. And the glyphosate in our foods, you heard, it's passing up even into distillation for making alcohol and ethanol. It's making it into the animals. It's making it into the liquids, whether or not you use that ethanol for fuel or you're making some sort of corn-based booze, you know? I mean, you got to imagine that it's making it into the food chain. All right, this is the last little clip that we're going to listen to here out of the series.
So what are the overall effects that this is having on plants and on livestock, on animals?
I have a letter that, or an email that I received from a veterinarian in another state. And he said, I've been working 3 years trying to find out why my hog producer that I'm supporting, servicing here, why we can't make any headway to keep him in business. He said, I've sent tissue into to various laboratories. We've checked for PRRS. They've checked for Clostridium toxins. They've checked for viruses. All of the known causes, and he said they're always negative. And when they've gotten that, I've been able to refer him to the veterinarians that can identify the organism. Those veterinarians then, in many situations, in a new situation where they haven't already gone through that very costly and long process of trying to find out what's happening, they've gone in and they've actually done split samples, and they'll send them in to check for all of the known causes. They come back negative, but it always comes back with this organism. Because of what we were seeing in both the plant epidemics of Gosses wilt and sudden death syndrome that were associated with the increase in infertility and abortions in cattle, pigs, chickens, and horses, that there was a direct concern with the continued use of, or abuse of the system without recognition of what those ties really meant, because the problem is continuing to get much more intense, much more damaging for our both our animal as well as our crop production systems.
And so we literally have this genocide, this eugenics going on in our crops and our livestock. And he said it was pigs, cows, and chickens that were all experiencing this death syndrome, and all of them, the sudden death, the spontaneous abortions, the lowered fertility, they are finding across the entire plant and animal kingdom. And they also are finding it in the honeybees. And this was the other piece that I wanted to share. We've listened to this before, but it's the same symptoms that are happening across the board with the insects, the animals, and the feed.
In the world, there are three characteristics that you see with colony collapse disorder. You see a malnutrition of the bees, especially with micronutrient malnutrition. You see a malnutrition in spite of having plenty of honey and bee bread and the resource in the hive, and yet the bees are malnourished. And the third characteristic there is disorientation, and so that the bees leave the hive, they're malnourished, they're under stress, and then fail to return to the hive. But if we look at all three of those characteristics of colony collapse disorder, we see that the most widely used herbicide in the world, probably the most abused herbicide or chemical that we've ever had in agriculture, glyphosate has an impact on all three of them.
And what's so insane, Dr. Huber, now like you said, we're going to look at his biography after we listen to this. When you understand where Dr. Huber has worked and what he has done in his last 50 years, you'll get why I am just so concerned over what's happening here. He is the man. He's been involved in our biowarfare program way back in the 50s and the 60s. He was part of Fort Detrick, Maryland, where they were doing a lot of the animal plant pathology under the biowarfare program. He totally has a pulse on what's going on. And now he's tying glyphosate, something that's been rubber stamped by the federal government, the USDA, Obama, and all of his insertees into the quote unquote regulatory agencies. This is being foisted upon us, and it is causing an apocalypse from the insect, the plant, and the animal population. Remember, Einstein said, once the bees are gone, we got about 5 years. But don't worry, because Harvard RoboBees has a solution. All right, let's get back to this. Glyphosate and the honeybees.
To start with, it's a very strong mineral chelator for essential minerals.
In this case, the chelation that's done by Roundup, or glyphosate, its active ingredient, it grabs onto important minerals, and it makes them unavailable for assimilation. So you may have copper, you may have selenium, you may have manganese in the system, but you can't use it.
All of those minerals that regulate our physiological processes that are critical for proper health and functioning and growth, that are are all reduced in availability for the bee. There's another factor that's involved from a health standpoint with the bee and also with digestion. Glyphosate is also a very potent antibiotic. Most of the beneficial organisms that we rely on and that the bee rely on, such as the lactobacillus and the bifidobacteria, are very sensitive to glyphosate. In the absence of those two bacteria in the honey crop or the bee stomach, the bee can't digest the food. It can have plenty of food there. And this is what we see with colony collapse disorder. You see,
I want to stop for 1 second because he said some very important things. So not only is it a mineral chelator where it's chelating out the essential nutrients out of the food that the bee is eating and trying to process for bodily nutrition, but it's also a potent antibiotic that kills your gut bacteria. And we've studied the gut bacteria and how important that is to the gut-brain axis with the vagus nerve. You know, having an imbalance of good to bad gut bacteria causes all kinds of issues. So if you're not, and even said between the bees and the humans and the animals, this is all happening in, and the soil as well. if it starts killing all this beneficial bacteria, this whole ecosystem that helps life survive on planet Earth, we have a really big problem. And let's see what's happening to the bees.
Plenty of honey, plenty of bee bread there, but they don't have the bacteria there so that they can digest it, so that they're essentially starving in the middle of food. I know Falk did a study about 2 years ago, 3 years ago now, just putting a little glyphosate in the water for the bees, and had about a 34% mortality from them. So,
what do you know how much was put into the water?
They were the rates that were common for the area that she set this study up in.
That is amazing, because we know that glyphosate is in the air and the water. If she set up the amount of parts per million in relationship to what's there in an ambient basis, especially in the Midwest where they use all this stuff a lot, and there was a 34% death rate, then that's pretty, I mean, is that a smoking gun? Can we call that a smoking gun?
Well, certainly a red flag that why aren't we doing the research?
It's a smoking red flag. It's a smoking red flag. Okay, we'll go there. I was very interested in the fact that Monsanto purchased a company called Biologics, where they were studying colony collapse disorder. And why would Monsanto take over this research company that might figure out what the cause of colony collapse disorder is? And now we're bringing in this new theory, which a lot of people believe that colony collapse disorder comes from a nicotine-based insecticide that's used as a seed treatment. They're called neonicotinoids. And you end up basically creating a time-release system in the seeds that produce this insecticide for the first few weeks of the crop. And this is known to create disorientation of bees. They can't find their ways back to the hive. They've banned these neonicotinoids in certain countries in Europe. They're trying to ban them in the United States. So, Don, would the neonicotinoids, or could they explain colony collapse disorder completely? Or are there anything that's missing that we need to look at something else?
I'm going to stop for 1 second. So they're absolutely right. I actually had that Biologic story queued up. You are seeing now in the research that they're coming out, oh, we discovered what's killing the bees. It's these neonicotinoids, and we have to ban them, and we have to ban them globally. And, I mean, anything that I have read, they are now, at least on paper, at least from the paid researchers, they are now pretty certain it's the neonicotinoids that are killing these bees. But Dr. Huber is the authority on plant disease and animal diseases and its relationship to glyphosate. He's now focused on the bees. Listen to what Dr. Huber has to say about this.
Well, they don't explain why the bee isn't able to digest the honey and the bee bread and that's in the hive, why it's starving to death, or why it's micronutrient deficient. The only explanation that I know of, at least, that really fits the picture and in that whole area is the broad exposure, continuous exposure to glyphosate, so that it's not an acute toxin, but as other scientists have found, that it's probably the most chronically toxic compound that we've ever had in our environment.
Ding, ding. How horrible is that? And, you know, when you think about it, so if organisms that consume glyphosate-laden crops can no longer properly uptake essential mineral nutrients and also have their beneficial gut bacteria destroyed that not only helps digest food and get those nutrients into the body, but also has a lot to do with your mental health as well as your immune system, we're going to start seeing in the human population illnesses that are associated with the ingestion of glyphosate. Your immune system isn't going to be as strong as it used to be. You're not going to be ingesting proper nutrients, even though you're eating enough food, and even though they're telling you you're obese and you need to cut back, even though they're telling you that, oh, beef causes cancer, so now you can't eat meat anymore, or any of this other stuff. I mean, there is a very scary picture that is forming here in regards to the future of our food system, and then add to that all the dying bees to pollinate the crops. We got a big problem. So let's take a look at Dr. Huber's biography now. We're going to look at his career overview because I want you to understand like how much in the know this guy is. I've been talking about him since I've gotten on air and first discovered Dr. Huber, and I still to this day am really hoping to be able to get an interview with him at some point. A brief career overview. Dr. Don M. Huber has a long, varied, and highly productive career focused on plant physiology, microbiology, and pathology. Don grew up on crop and dairy farms in Arizona and in Idaho, and his training from both the University of Idaho, where he got his BS and his MS, and Michigan State University, where he got his PhD in 1963, was augmented by U.S. Army military service in sensitive areas such as global epidemiology, national production capabilities, and national security. That made me go, huh? A family man, he takes the education of his children and grandchildren seriously, serving 12 years on the local school board, and at the request of the Indiana governor, he served on the Indiana Education Employment Relations Board 7 years as mediator and fact finder for conciliation of collective bargaining disputes. Dr. Huber began his 50-year academic career with 8 years of service as a cereal pathologist, and cereal as in C-E-R-E-A-L, grains, not cereal, S-E-R-I-A-L, a cereal pathologist at the University of Idaho. He taught, researched, and published at Purdue University for 35 years, and his field was soil-borne disease control, physiology of disease, and microbial ecology, a perfect fit which reinforced his unique military work. He is now Professor Emeritus of Purdue University. Professor Huber received his commission as an Army officer in the active reserve in 1957 after 4 years in the National Guard, and his early military career, he researched with a select group of scientists to study the impact of nuclear war with specific effects of fallout on agriculture and how to recover from such an attack. From 1963 to 1971, he was assigned to the U.S. Army Edgewood Proving Ground and Fort Detrick Biological Laboratory in Maryland for research in chemical and biological warfare. Now, what's so interesting about this is if you guys remember in 1972, that's when Nixon inked that agreement that we agreed we no longer were going to develop biological weapons at places like Fort Detrick and Plum Island. So it was the year after they inked the agreement. Dr. Huber became operations officer, S3 level, in a USAR medical group, that's the U.S. Army Medical Group, before moving to the Medical Intelligence Department of Defense. In 1973, he took command of a specialized strategic medical intelligence detachment unit assigned to the Office of the Surgeon General and the U.S. Army Medical Intelligence and Information Agency, assisting the formation of the Armed Forces Medical Intelligence Center, which is now called the NCMI. He carried out these duties while also serving as professor at Purdue. Though technically in the Army Reserve, Dr. Huber, whose expertise was in the Soviet Union's biological warfare program, was part of an elite 9 and 10 person team of specialized world scientists, And in this capacity, he commanded the MIDS for 8 years. That's the Medical Intelligence Division. Most of these scientists, including Dr. Huber, worked overtime without pay, and he then moved from command of MIDS to the senior medical intelligence analyst, and then as associate director of the Armed Forces Medical Intelligence Center. I mean, this dude is no small potatoes, and he's the one that's coming out saying he's done all this research and finding all these issues with glyphosate, writing letters to Tom Vilsack and Obama saying, yo, back up the truck, Chuck, and nobody's listening. Retiring from the military service after more than 41 years, he continues to work with our intelligence community where he actively participates in oversight security of what? Oh, our biological weapons program and threat pathogen concerns to crops. Dr. Huber teaches courses on anti-crop bioterrorism and serves as a consultant on biological weapons of mass destruction and emerging diseases. He advises, so this is what he's currently doing, as well as being a professor at Purdue. He advises U.S. agencies on bioterrorism and biological warfare, and he currently serves without pay. Now talk about taking advantage of someone. If I were this dude, man, I wouldn't be helping them at all. He currently serves without pay as the American Phytopathological Society's coordinator for the USDA National Plant Disease Recovery System Program and is an active member of the Threat Pathogen Committee. So he currently serves without a penny in tax dollars or from any agency as the American Phytopathological Society's coordinator to the USDA's National Plant Disease Recovery System Program and sends a letter to Tom Vilsack. And nobody cares. How disturbing is this? So I wanted to, and I mean, this goes on and on. And if anyone is interested, I'm going to put Dr. Huber's bio into the notes of the show today. It goes on for 10 pages of all of the things that Dr. Huber has been involved in, all the agencies he's helped, all the research he's done, all the papers he's published. And you will see that if there was anyone who would understand the breakdown that is currently happening in our food chain, it would be Dr. Huber. I mean, this guy, he looks pretty old, and I hope he sticks around for a lot more years, because Dr. Huber is the only scientist that I've seen that's connected all the dots together and has the credentials behind him to back him up. And I even have to give him more kudos when I look at his history and his involvement with the federal government, with the Department of Defense, with the biological warfare program that he's currently involved with even. And he's standing up because he's got ethics and morals, saying that something is very wrong. You know, you got to give it to him to at least be standing up and speaking the truth. All right. So now what we're going to look at is something that we've talked about a lot. And this is some of this newfangled GMO technology that's happening, and it's not just in our foods, it's in our vaccines as well. This RNAi technology, we also looked at some spray-on RNAi back a while ago that Monsanto was toying with to get around any GMO regulations that will come out in the future. You know, there's all these other countries around the world. You know, the United States has always been GMO friendly, but other countries around the world have banned GMO crops, and rightly so. But with these international trade agreements, they're going to circumvent those, okay? They're going to get rid of labeling. You don't need to know where it comes from, and you don't need to know what's in it. And even if they have to label things, they are now looking for ways to get around the current laws or the current definitions of genetically modified while still modifying them. So a story came out of Bloomberg. Brandon Turville also wrote a story about this. We've talked about this a lot, but let's look at this. says this is an it surprised me. It's one thing when alternative media writes about this, but it's another thing when it comes out in Bloomberg. This is no way to regulate GMOs is the title of the story written October 21st, 2015. Scientists say that they hope to avoid government regulation of genetically modified organisms by using a variant on a powerful new method to knock out some plant genes. This thinking is worrisome, not so much for scientific reasons as for legal ones. When research is aimed at achieving a regulatory goal rather than a scientific one, it's a sign that something is wrong with the regulations and that they need to be changed sooner rather than later. Now, the question is, whose side is Bloomberg on? So we have these genetic modification companies who are looking for loopholes in the current laws that are supposed to be protecting the public against these types of things. And Bloomberg is coming out saying, well, there must be something wrong then with the regulatory laws if they have to circumvent them and not a scientific problem. I think they got it twisted a little bit there. So just like the medical industry with the 21st Century Care Act, let's get rid of any of the protections that are out there in the FDA for testing and go direct to consumer, because you know what? People are dying without these untested cures out there. Well, now I guess they're going to say people are starving because we're in an ecological disaster and the food's not getting out there because regulatory agencies are blocking GMOs. And what twisted logic is this? We were the ones that messed up this ecological issue. And the food itself, it's what is killing biology. Anyway, back to the story. The research in question was done by scientists at Seoul National University in South Korea. They used a three-year-old technique called what? Da-da-da-da, CRISPR. We've talked about CRISPR. CRISPR-Cas9. That's easy to use cut-and-paste gene editing. It says they're using a three-year-old technique called CRISPR, which enables scientists to edit a genome in a remarkably precise fashion using viral DNA. What's remarkable isn't the science. CRISPR is already being widely used, but the objective. The researchers, now we looked at CRISPR, and one of the things they were doing with CRISPR was using it as a gene drive to be able to engineer genetic modifications into creatures such as, mosquitoes, so that when they inserted the gene that, I think of that one experiment, the gene required the mosquitoes to have tetracycline. And once they let them out where there was no tetracycline in the environment, they all died within a generation. There was another one where it affected a protein that was required when they reproduced. So they could mate. So the male genetically modified mosquito could be released into the wild and mate. The female mosquito would lay the eggs, but a necessary protein for survival was missing. And so that entire next generation of mosquitoes withered and died from starvation. And they've been talking about now the dangers of gene drives, because they could do that to any population of living organism. Engineer something that within a generation will wipe them out. And all this technology is so new, and our understanding of genomics is so new, they still don't understand by flipping one switch how it'll affect another. And that's why now the entire planet Earth and all that lives upon it has become the real-time petri dish of experimentation. Don't we see how this is like the bus without brakes at 180 miles an hour driving at the cliff? Because everybody, not everybody, but the majority of the populace that reads mainstream news believes that this is a good thing. And we just wear tinfoil hats because we are anti-science, dumb, outback, uneducated people who don't understand what's going on. It's eugenics of the planet. says, anyway, what's remarkable isn't the science. CRISPR is already being widely used, but the objective researchers' innovation has to do with how CRISPR is introduced into the genome scientists seek to modify. Ordinarily, CRISPR is applied to a genome using a bacterium vehicle, and this means that CRISPR-modified genomes ordinarily come under GMO regulations. And these regulations, enforced by the Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service of the Agriculture Department, apply when a plant pest is introduced into an existing genome. The bacterium vehicle, usually Agrobacterium tumefaciens, is regulated as a plant pest. Well, the Korean researchers developed a technique to introduce RNA necessary to do the editing without using the Agrobacterium as a vehicle. And this editing process would be the same, knocking out genes that researchers want to eliminate, but the delivery technique is different. So now what they're doing is infecting the genes with a bacterium that then goes in and modifies the genome. Their goal wasn't scientific improvement, but regulatory avoidance. In terms of science, our approach is just another improvement in the field of genome editing, says one scientist. However, in terms of regulation and public acceptance, our method could be path-breaking because this new organism might be exempt from current GMO regulations. And hey, it sounds like actually they're on our side. If this sentence doesn't bother you, it should. The researchers were openly acknowledging that the point of their efforts is to work around existing GMO regulations. And if the regulations don't apply, it's because they're outdated. The APHIS regulations apply to plant pests because they themselves are an adaptation of traditional pre-GMO regulatory authority, but the scientific dangers of genetic modification using CRISPR don't depend on the use of bacterium to effectuate the editing process. So, guys, put on a seatbelt, and if we even get one more step, and I think we're going to run out of time here. Tomorrow we're going to continue, I guess, and we're going to look at now this whole processed meat as well as beef, chicken, pork, any type of red meat as well as processed foods cause cancer, but don't worry about it because the UN is coming out full frontal to explain to you how eating bug protein is more nutritious and better for you than eating a steak. Make sure you get on your Apple iPhone tracker, health tracker, and get the nanobots in your blood, because the 21st century white wall UN agenda 21 precision medicine world is on our doorstep, and glyphosate is helping bring that to fruition. All right, guys, well, make sure you stick around because tonight is Wednesday and we have Ms. Lonnie Clark up next. And at 6 p.m. Eastern, Josh with Auntie Terry News, the boys from New York at 8, Truth or Talk with April and Verstein at 9, and Auntie Media with Nick and DB at 11. All right, guys, have an awesome Wednesday and we will catch up with you tomorrow. Everybody take care.
Okay, because I'm trying to get, you know, what the buttons are, the motivating buttons for them to. Okay, so it's really more just to kind of get after.
Yeah, we're on here right now.
Okay.
Sure, so yes, I'm going.